Capital Radio started their journey through my record collection. It takes a long, long time to build up a big audience. It takes no time at all to lose them. It was as though my toy set had been taken away from me.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we hear from those who made a difference. Phil Swern.
My grandfather gave me a wind-up gramophone when I was about 3 years old. And I was fascinated by this thing, and he gave me a pile of 78s. And my parents' party piece was to have friends around and ask me to play a particular record, the Perry Como, Coopy Doll or something. And from a pile of about 60 or 78s, I'd go and pick out the record, put it on the player and play it. It'd be the right track, right record. I couldn't read at that time, obviously. And from there on in, I mean, I just absolutely loved the concept of records. And when we had a radiogram, one of those great big things where the music came out, the speakers, was fantastic. So, as I was growing up, on birthdays, Saturdays, when my parents felt like treating me, they'd take me to a toy shop, not interested. I wanted to go to the record shop, buy a Dickie Valentine record, a Tommy Steele record, whatever, and that's what happened. And so, most Saturdays, providing my behaviour had been good, I'd get a record bought for me. Well, I grew up in Wembley. I mean, I was born in Ealing. My parents paid for some piano lessons, but I had this mad professor who played violin and piano and tried to teach me, and he was trying to teach me Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto and things like that, where I wanted to be the Russ Conway. So that didn't really work, because if I learned to play a piece, I'd have to jazz it up, and he used to go mad. And he used to ring up my parents and say, "Your son, I'm trying to teach him this piece of music. It should be played like this," and he plays it down the phone. And he plays it like this, and I go, "No, I don't." I wrote to record companies, wrote to the BBC, wrote to any media company, and always the standard letters: what GCEs have you got? What A levels? What O levels? No, nothing. So my parents, again, they said, "Well, you've got to do something," and they paid for me to have an apprenticeship with Fidel Sassoon in hairdressing. So I did a 3-year term with them, which I hated every minute of it. Well, when I say every minute, the only upside to it was that quite a few well-known personalities came into the salon to have their hair done, and I used to get on really well with them. I was a junior, and I was shampoo, that's what I was doing, shampooing them, and quite a lot of them used to beeline for me to wash their hair because they liked talking music.
Nobody can tell you there's only one song worth singing.
Mama Cass came into Sassoon's, and I washed her hair a few times. We're talking now sort of 65. She would give me a £5 tip, which was probably what, about £100 now. And I just, the first time she did it, I just looked at it in amazement. I said, "Do you want some change or something?" "No, no, that's for you." So off I went, toddled every once I'd made enough tips to go around to the record shop. There I'd go around to One Stop Records in South Moulton Street, and that's where they got all the imports and new releases. And that's where I met Elton John, another record collector, an avid record collector. I think he worked in the shop for a while, and occasionally we'd go out for a cup of coffee and see what he'd bought, what I'd bought, and so we'd chat about records that were coming out, what we'd bought, what we hadn't bought. I mean, obviously, he was very ambitious even then, like I was. And he used to whinge because he couldn't get a publishing deal. I whinged because I couldn't work for a record company. And it was so it was a bit of a whinge. But funnily enough, I saw him about 6 months ago, but he was in Radio 2, and I bumped into him. And he remembered all that. We reminded him, yeah. And he wasn't telling stories, because he reminded me of stuff that happened. So it was really nice to see him after quite a long time.
Loneliness.
So anyway, yes. So amongst other people, the Walker brothers would come in the evening and have their hair done. They'd go downstairs away from the real business. So I used to stay behind and look after them. And there's a journalist who worked for a magazine called Disc Music Echo, I think it was Disc originally, Penny Valentine. She was the record reviewer. And we got on really well. We became very good friends. One day I was a particularly bad day, and she came in and I said, "I can't stand this anymore, I really." She said, "Well, there's a label that's just started. I can put you in touch, and let's see if we can get you a job." So she put me in touch with Strike Records, that had just had their first, and only hit with That's Nice by Neil Christian. She arranged a meeting. I tootled along there to, I think it was up at Berkeley Street near Marble Arch, and they were running their offices illegally in a block of flats. So I went in there to hear the shuffling of typewriters and machinery being put away before the door was opened. I went along, they gave me a job as a runner, which was fantastic. I just loved it. I was going around delivering records to the BBC and meeting producers and things like that. So I got to know quite a lot of the producers just purely by delivering records. And Tony Blackburn was just about to come off Radio London. He did Midday Spin for the Light programme for a short while and was then told he was going to do the breakfast show. So that's how I first got to know Tony, which was way back in the, it must have been about 67, 66. But it was before Radio 1 started, so it must have been end of 66.
21 minutes to 1 o'clock on the BBC Live programme. This is Midday Spin, and here's a new from Jay and the Technique, and the title of this one.
Well, what I remember Tony is he was always quite shy. He didn't engage in conversation that much. But we did find we had a very similar type of humour. And then on the breakfast show, he was obviously telling these really terrible one-liners. And I used to feed him quite a lot of them.
Take my father, for instance, I wish you would. He's got one tooth and right in the middle of his mouth. He's the only person I know in winter with central eating.
So Strike Records, they thought they were EMI because they'd had one small hit and they're spending money left, right and centre. And they basically were about to fold. And two of the directors went to work for RCA and took me with them. So I went to RCA doing much the same. And then after that, someone I knew in the business said, if you're interested, there's a guy at Transatlantic Records who's looking for a promotion man. He said, go and see him, Nat Joseph, who ran Transatlantic and all those big blues and folk artists. So I went along to see him. I knew some of the radio producers, but not that well, but so I reeled off all these names, the people I knew, which I didn't really, but so I got the job. So I had a crash course in record plugging. Then, after being there a couple of years, I really enjoyed my work there. The money wasn't very good. I was sitting at my desk and the phone rings. There's a guy who sat in the next office, the sales director, who we were really friendly and we used to play terrible jokes on each other, terrible things. So the phone rang and this voice said, hi, is that Phil Swearer? And I said, yes. This is Jerry Mart of A&M Records. I said, piss off, or I'm busy. He said, no, this is Jerry Moss. Oh no, it is Jerry Moss, oh dear. So I went to meet him at the Cumberland Hotel, and he said, oh, we're breaking away from Pi, we're going to do our own distribution, we're going to become our own label, we'd like you to come and join us as head of promotion. So he offered me what seemed like a fortune at the time. I didn't really think I was up to it, so I went back to Nat Joseph and I said, look, I've been offered this job. If you can up my money by about £10 a week, I'll stay with you, but I'm really finding it difficult to live on what you're paying me. He said, well, I can't. So off I went. A&M, that was my last job as such, as an employee.
You see this guy's in love with you.
A&M at that time was just really, I mean, they'd had quite a few hits with Sam Pipers, Sergio Mendes, Herb Albert, obviously, but they were, I suppose, regarded as more of a middle-of-the-road label at that time. It was quite exciting because when I joined, they'd just done a deal with Phil Spector, and he'd just produced an album with Checkmates Limited, and there's Ronettes, and so it was all good times. But the trouble is, as always with Spector, he was costing a fortune to make these records. They then started developing a bit more with Supertramp and acts like that, by which time they brought in new management who we didn't really see eye to eye, and I thought it's time to move on. And reggae was just starting to kick in. Young Gifted and Black had just entered the charts. And one of the records that I promoted, was one of the Phil Spector records, was Black Pearl by Sonny Charles and the Checkmates. And I thought this was such a great record, but I always felt that the tempo was wrong. And I thought this would make an absolutely great reggae record. I really had very little idea of how to make a record, how to produce a record or what, but I just thought if they gave a Young Gifted and Black treatment to this record, I think we could be on to a winner. Young Gifted and Black. So I found the arranger, Johnny Arthur, who'd done the strings for Young Gifted and Black, contacted him. I said, do you want to help me? I've got this idea. We'll find the artist. Let's make the record, we'll just do it as a joint production. And that's how Black Pearl came to be. He helped with the musicians, the arrangements, the whole lot. I mean, they were Jamaican musicians on the record. We recorded it at a little studio near the Roundhouse. So that was the start.
Black Pearl, precious little girl.
When Black Pearl came out, Tony Blackburn was a great supporter of it. I mean, he's been a friend of mine for years anyway, but he really supported it. And Tim Blackmore, his then producer, also loved it. And Tim and I, we go back a long way, we're good friends. And I was actually, I remember it was a Tuesday morning, I was walking around Radio 1, and Tim comes up to me behind me and taps me on the shoulder. He said, "I've got something to show you." And he showed me the top 40, the and there's my record. I think it was a number that came in at 36. I said, "Thanks, Tim." I just ran to the gents and cried. And the record went, I think, got into the top. Yeah, it got to about 13, I think it got to in the end. That was the start of the production and an association with Johnny Arthey, because then we made records with the Pearls. A few other things we did. There was the Polly Brown. We had big success with Up in a Puff of Smoke in America, which I co-wrote with Jerry Shurey, the arranger. She was the quietest person I ever worked with. It was very nice. Again, we got on very well, but very, very quiet. And I could never really read, you know, whether she was liking something or not. But we did okay with that record. Well, probably one of my favourite records, production records, was the R&J Stone record, We Do It. I met Russell and Joanne purely by the fact that they came in to do some backing vocals for us, and they were singing with the James Last Orchestra, and one of the Pearls, Lynn Cornell, she was also in with the James Last, and she said, "You ought to meet Russell because he's written a whole load of songs," which she said I think are really good. So I met with him. He brought me a massive reel of tape with goodness knows how many songs on. I played them. They're all very nice songs, except We Do It just stuck out as the song. So I rang him up and I said to him, "I've listened. I said I'd really like to make a record of We Do It." He said, "I don't like that one." He said, "There's so many better." I said, "I'll tell you what, you choose one, I'll choose one, and we'll see which one turns out best. And that was, otherwise, I'm not really interested." So we came to that agreement, and he could hear on the day, or they could both hear on the day, that We Do It was going to be the side.
Just when I think I'm getting tired of you again, you turn her right back and give her that special smile again.
It took a long, long time for that record to get in the charts. I touted it around to most record companies and turned it down. In the end, a friend of mine, RCA, I said, "I just want to get this record out. Can you? I really do believe in it." And I managed to get it released, and we got a few plays. And Tony Blackburn, again, he absolutely loved it. Even to this day, he says it's one of his favourite records.
And We Do It.
I think the record had been out nearly 3 months, and it got to Christmas. So I thought it was dead in the water. And Tony said to me, he said, "I know this is a hit. Let's leave it till after Christmas. I'm going to make it Record of the Week on my show," which he did, and that sent it flying.
And I'm going to leave you with, the last record I'm going to play on the show means a lot to me, because it was produced by my very best friend, and he's seen me through the pretty rough times just lately. R&J Stone, it's called We Do It. It goes back to January 1976.
Yeah, well, I carried on producing a few records after We Do It, and then punk reared its ugly head, and I thought, this is not for me. And Warner Brothers, Guy, one of the big bosses at Warner Brothers, who I'd known at A&M, called me up and said, we'd like you to come over to America because we'd like to discuss some sort of deal with you." So they flew me over to Los Angeles, and I spent a week there, and I had these meetings with Warners. They offered me a deal for a publishing and production deal, and I said, "Can I think about it?" And I remember getting back on the plane, and I was sitting next to this big Texan, and we got chatting, and he asked me what I did, and I just told him, I said, "I'm in this dilemma," and he's, "Man, if it don't suit you, don't do it." And I thought, if I don't get into radio now, if I don't get into, I never will. I've always had a great love for radio, even in my growing up.
Radio Luxembourg, your station of the stars.
I would have two transistor radios under the bedclothes because I couldn't bear hearing things in one ear. So I'd be listening to radio all through the night, Radio Luxembourg, and even before that, I'd listen to comedy on the radio, listen to music programs on the light program. And I'm just fascinated with radio. I used to go to lots and lots of radio shows, the recordings. I used to go to Easy Beat and, well, numerous music shows. I used to bribe the commissionaires at the BBC studios with cigarettes and chocolates to get in to see the shows. And so they knew me, and they'd normally reserve me tickets. So I was quite known around the BBC quarters for my love of radio.
Paul, now, hush. Paul, we've just heard the good news that you and the boys have been chosen to appear in this year's Royal Variety performance.
And I absolutely, seeing these producers on stage discussing how the programme's going to be made, I thought, I want to do that. I really, really want to do that. So I came home from America, said to Warners, I'm not going to do this deal. And they said, well, who are you going to go with? I said, I'm not going with anyone. I'm giving up record production, that whole side of things. Then I got a phone call from David Rees, who was a journalist, and he was putting together a marathon music quiz for Radio 1, which was going to run for 36 hours. Now, he was going to write the questions, but he wanted a music clip to go with every question. It was hundreds and hundreds of music clips. And I went along for meeting the BBC, Radio 1, and discussed it with them, and they said, well, we can't pay you very much, but if you'd like to do it, we'd love you to do it. So I took that job on board, and I made 36 hours of music clips for Radio 1. Happily, there was not one thing out of place in the whole 36 hours. 36 reels of tape, all leaded up with every clip. And it took forever to do it. And I thought, not bad. So I thought, Radio 1 are bound to give me some work now. Nah, nothing. And at this point, I met up with Tim Blackmore, who had previously worked at Radio 1, produced Tony Blackburn and Noel Edmonds and people like that. He was producing a show called You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet on Capital, which is a Sunday lunchtime show presented by a guy named Jeremy Pascal, who's another journalist.
You ain't heard nothing yet, and I'm not sure I want to.
And there was a wacky music quiz, a bit of film in there, but lots of wacky records and lots of crazy music rounds. And Tim and I had lunch. I said, I love this programme. I said, absolutely, never miss it. And he said, well, we're just about to end the series. He said, we won't be able to do any more because we just haven't got enough material to... I said, I could keep that programme going for 10 years with my record collection. Well, I've been collecting records since I was, well, since my grandfather gave me the part of 78, and I carried on. I was given records every week by my parents and birthdays. That's all. So my record collection was building quite nicely. I was very fortunate that during my school days I lived very close to a broadcaster named Steve Race, who I went along to recording one of his shows, and I'd seen him in the street quite a lot. And at the end of the show, I waited for him and took a lot of courage. But I went up to him and said, oh, hi, Mr. Race, I'm one of your neighbours. And he gave me a lift home. And he said, oh, I get stacks of stuff. He said, I never keep them. He said, if you'd like to take a few, then please do. And most weeks, he said, just knock on the door when you're passing on a Tuesday, and I'll just take a few records. And so that helped build up the collection as well. And as soon as I was earning money, I was buying records. So anyway, I was doing this You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet, and we could see that we could get another series out of it. All I got out of it was a credit at the end of the programme, which was fine, but not paying the rent. So anyway, that series went ahead. Then they decided they wanted to do a third series. And I said, well, I can't do it. I need to be on the payroll of the quiz, and I want to be part of it. I had a meeting at Capital, and they agreed that the format would be that three Capital presenters would play three visitors. So you'd have maybe three pop stars or whatever, or politician or whatever. But that's how the team was made up. And one day, I think it was around about the fifth series, I said to the team, the production team, I said, Roger Scott has never done this show. And they said, oh, he'd never do that. He would poo-poo this us taking the mickey out of pop music. He'd hate it. I said, can I go and ask him? Yeah, go on then. And they're all sort of sniggering and thinking, I'm going to get my head bitten off. So I went into his office on the other side. I remember it was the other side of the... knocked on the door. Yes. I said, oh, Mr. Scott, it's Phil. I know who you are. I said, oh, it's going well. I was just wondering... Yes. I was just wondering if you'd like to take part in You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet one week. So I was wondering whether they're going to get round to asking me, well, when would you want me to do it? And we became really good friends, and I ended up producing his programme as well, both for Capital Gold and later on Radio 1.
Things on Capital get even better, if that's possible, after the news, but now we plummet to the depths of dross, dredged up my Phillips wine.
Thank you.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, due to unpopular demand from last week, I brought them back.
What?
The Singing Bunnies.
Oh, the best argument yet for Mixed Metallica.
So that was the start of my real career in radio, working on that, because from that I got other programmes to do for them. In fact, when it started, Aidan Day, who was the programme director, came to me, and he knew about my record collection, and he borrowed, they borrowed about 1,000 records off me, because they just dubbed them onto a cart, because they had no library. So Capital Radio started their journey through my record collection.
Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Waters. Good morning from myself, David Simons. The time is 5:09 on the first day of Capital Radio.
So when you went into Capital, there's a big open plan area with lots of producers and DJs. Producer would sit with their presenter, etc., etc. Well, Jo Sanderson towards the end was the programme controller, and she left. And they brought in Richard Park. Do you know Richard Park? Right, okay. So Richard Park bowls in, and he comes up to me and he says, "We're going to start up Capital Gold." He says, "I want you to be involved with Capital Gold with me." I said, "Okay." So again, the loan of my record collection, all my record collection was basically running Capital Gold. So I bring in my pile of records and put together virtually the whole day. So I bring a massive box of records every week. Richard and I went to America, went to New York to see some of the gold stations, how they operated over there. So for a while I was left to my own devices, and it's paid really very well.
Shall we? Let's have a look at the weather. Thank you, Kenny.
Then I get a phone call about a year in. I get a phone call from Johnny Bearding, who's now controller of Radio 1. And he said to me, oh, Roger Scott, you know, we've signed him. Roger would really like you to produce his Sunday evening show. And it was already on the air, and Roger was doing it himself. And I said, well, why would he want me to do that? So anyway, I think I then rang Roger, and Roger said, no, I've got so much stuff going on, I'm having fly backwards and forwards to America, I haven't really got time to put it together. You're the only person I would trust to do it. So I called Johnny back, and we went out for dinner. And I said, I can't just give up what I'm doing for one show a week. He said, well, what else would you like to do? And I said, well, I'd like to do it, everything. But he said, well, Alan Freeman is coming to do Pick of the Pops with us in the new form. Would you like to produce that? And I said, great. So I went in to see dear old Richard and told him that I was... And he went mad. And I said, look, Richard, I've agreed with Radio 1 that I can stay and help you out until you've got everything sorted. He said, no, just go. So I went. So I had a very long and enjoyable spell with Radio 1, doing Roger Scott's Sunday Night, doing Pick of the Pops, ended up doing Round Table with Mike Reed, and numerous other specials for Radio 1.
Stereo sequence on Radio 1. I'm Roger Scott. We're in FM stereo across the UK between 88 and 91 megahertz. That was where you'll find us, in stereo. Coming up on the sequence this afternoon, we'll be taking a tour of New Jersey with Bon Jovi, and you'll hear this lady.
I still used to go back to America quite a bit. And obviously at that time, there wasn't, you didn't have the internet, so I bring back imports from America, because I'd go around to the record companies, I'd go into Tower Records, whatever, and I'd annoy the hell out of the labels over here, because I'd come back with Bruce Springsteen's new record 5 weeks before it had been released, and Roger would play it and things like that. I remember the Doobie Brothers got terrible trouble with, brought a record there, the Doctor it was called. I actually got off the plane Sunday afternoon and dashed into the studio with it, and we put it on the air that night. EMI were not best pleased.
Greetings, Pop Biggers. It is Pick of the Pops. And of course, our thanks to DLT for the last three bright and breezy hours on Formidable 1FM, and it's Pick of the Pops till 2:30, and the golden ones taken from the complete top tens from the years 1966, 1977, and 1989. And included in the lineup this very afternoon.
Well, Pick of the Pops in those days, it was always an oldies chart. We'd always go back to 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever. Those days, no CDs, so it was all off vinyl. I'd pick a chart this week in another year. I have to put out all the records, time them all, and make it work into hour or 2 hour show. I'd then meet up with Fluff, and I'd just send him the running order. I'd probably be working about 2 or 3 weeks in advance, so that he could write. He always wrote his own intros and things. He didn't use a script for anything else, but he'd write the intro. I said, these are the records we are playing. These are the records we aren't playing. Is there anything that I'm not playing that you'd like to play? And that's how it was put together. I used to go in the studio with him every week, and then we'd go out for lunch or something afterwards, depending on what time, because the time slot moved a bit.
And here it is, the last time up, the Pick of the Pops Top 20. New at 20, Moldy Old Do from Left Handed Pigeon. Down at 19 is Silver Machine coming from Hawkwind.
The sound of the swinging cymbal, which is the signature of Pick of the Pops. I mean, he voiced it over it so many times, it just became natural. He had the chart in front of him, and he'd just read down the chart, and he'd hit the right place every single time.
Staying at 12, Living in Harmony. That's Pick of the Pops. Cliff Richard.
Yeah, I recall. Well, Fluff's last programme, he brought in, Del Winton came into the studio, and they did a discussion as to how it would be, and Fluff said to Del, please look up, be careful and look after my baby. And Del said, I'll take good care of it. And that was quite a moving moment when he ended his Pick of the Pops days, because he'd been on it for, well, I think since the 60s, on and off, in various forms.
You've been listening to the weekending the 5th of July, 1975.
So he came in, he did it, and he did it okay. I think he did it reasonably well for a while. Unfortunately, may he rest in peace, he got the TV show during that period, the lottery, which took up so much of his time. And I think Pick of the Pops did suffer because of the way he was having to spend time doing the lottery.
And don't forget to join Dale Winton for the normal Pick of the Pops tomorrow at 2 o'clock on Radio 2. Ta-ra. On 88 to 91 FM Radio 2 from the BBC.
I knew Fluff for a long time. He used to come around to my parents for lunch on a Sunday, to have lunch and then go and do Pick of the Pops live on a Sunday. Originally, that's back in the late 60s, early 70s. So I knew Fluff for a long time. He was really good fun. I miss him a lot. He was a really good friend.
That's it. It's coming up to 2 o'clock. Thank you for your company. Thank you for your support. And thank you for your kindness. And thank you to Phil Swern for the hard work he puts in on this show every weekend.
Sadly, when Roger Scott passed away, they were looking for a replacement, and Andy Peebles did it for a short while. Then it was suggested that Bob Harris did it, and I knew Bob from old. So Bob was brought in to do the Sunday show for a while, and that worked very nicely, so I carried on producing it. And then Johnny said to us, they said, I really like the Sunday show, but how would you like to do 4 nights a week? No, it was something like 10 till 2, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. So then we did that for years, that show.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that man's music. And there he was, live on the programme.
And then Matthew Bannister came along, took over the reins at Radio 1, and he decided to make a clean sweep of everything. So the first show he acts was our overnight show, because, oh, you're playing all these old records, which we weren't, because he hadn't really, obviously, listened to it that in that depth, because we were playing, breaking lots of new artists. Obviously it was mixed with the Fleetwood Macs and the Simon and Garfunkels and things like that, but a lot of new material. But we were out, and that was basically the end of Radio 1.
And I talked about Phil Swern at great length on the programme last night, and I said with Phil in the studio today, I wasn't going to embarrass him by going all through it, but, you know, Phil and I will be continuing to work together. The working relationship that we've built up between us is the most special that I've ever had, and there's no way I'm going to let it go. Phil and I are going to continue to work together from now on. And really to you...
Well, I mean, everyone was in fear of their position, quite rightly, because virtually everything changed overnight. I think this has happened a few times. I think it's a very big mistake that people make with rate. They want to change. They decide change. I'm all for change. You've got to have change, but don't change every program straight away. You need to do it one at a time. One program, replace that one, replace that one. Then you don't lose your core audience. If you get rid of everything all at once, it's happened. I've seen it happen over and over again, and still they make the same mistake. It takes a long, long time to build up a big audience. It takes no time at all to lose them. I was devastated leaving Radio 1 because I was having such a great time with. I mean, it was as though my toy set had been taken away from me. It's shocking. I went to see Radio 2. And I was actually making some. I was quite fortunate because I was making some quiz shows for Radio 2. There's a show called Pop Score, which Ken Bruce presented, but as Ray Moore before that. And the producer of that was a guy named Richard Wilcox. And Tony Blackburn was team captain of one side, and Terry Wogan was on the other side. And Tony used to ask me to take me along to the recordings nearly every. I think they did it every fortnight, two at a time. And Tony would plonk me in the front row and come off the stage and get the answers off me. Terry Wogan kicked off and said, if you're going to do that, I want him sitting my side for the second recording. In the end, after about 3 weeks of this, a producer came out of the control room, grabbed me and threw me out. And I remember saying to him, "Don't you worry, mate, I'll be doing your job very soon." Funnily enough, 2 years later, I get a phone call from him. He said, "How would you like to write the questions for Pop Score?" So I ended up writing Pop Score with Ken Bruce presenting it, which was, I suppose, to a writer, it's probably been like being commissioned to write The Archers or something. It's just amazing. I had such fun with that. Later years, Alan Freeman was team captain one side and Helen Shapiro the other. Alan Freeman just could not take it seriously, and he just kept losing points. It nearly ends up every week in a minus score.
Okay, next on the list today is Paul Jenkins from Starbridge in the West Midlands. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Ken.
How are you doing?
Popmaster started when Ken took over that 9 o'clock slot. I'd known Ken for a while. He and his producer said, "Let's go have lunch." I think the programme had actually started, and they said, we need to put a quiz into the programme. So we went out for lunch, had two bottles of wine, came up with a quiz. And it's done really well. There's a big switch on at 10:30 on Radio 2, and factory workers, they break for that. We had our kitchen fitted, just a new one fitted about 6 months ago, and I said to the guy, "Do you want tea?" I asked about 10 o'clock. He said, "Well, can I have it at 10:30 because we'd like to listen to Popmaster." He didn't know I had anything to do with it, but it's a monumental task, because we supply everything to them. They've the questions, the music clips, the whole package is delivered to them.
Enya's solo chart career began in 1988.
But you can never write that many questions, 400-500 a month, without something slipping through the net. But we do have quite vigorous checks. Questions I write, one of the colleagues would check them, BBC production team would look at them. Very few get through. There have been a couple that made it to air, but over the period it's very, very few. But all you can do is do your best to stop it from happening. I mean, we've now done a couple of Popmaster quiz books. I've just done a deal for a new book, which is coming out not this Christmas, but sometime next summer or autumn. So we're starting on a new book. So when we left Radio 1, I think Frances Lyon was still in control there, but she was They were still playing The Carpenters, and I got told off for playing a 15-second Status Quo track in the pop quiz. But anyway, Jim Moyer came in, who I'd met a few times because he was being head of light entertainment for television. I knew him a bit, but so I went along to see him, and I suggested that he gave Bob Harris a show on Radio 2, and he said, no, I don't think so just yet. It's not quite, I need to find my feet. And every couple of months I'd ring him up or go along or knock on his door, and yes, and I got a phone call, and he said, right, this is what's going to happen at Christmas and New Year. He said, I want you and Bob to do a program every evening, a 2-hour program. If it works and we get a good reaction, we'll discuss a series afterwards. If it doesn't work, you'll never work for the BBC again. How does that sound? So that's what we did. I rang Bob, said, you up for this? And off we went. Made 10 programmes for Radio 2, which got a huge reaction. I mean, Jim, bless him, right at the end of the very first show, the phone rang, the red light phone, and we thought, oh dear. And he said, oh no, we're really, really happy. We'll discuss in the new year. And that's how the overnights happened with Bob, which he only finished this year. But Bob was unwell for a while, and that time various other people did the show for a bit. And when Bob came back, he wanted to pre-record it, and for a variety of reasons, I thought, right, I need to move on to do other stuff as well. So I still see Bob, and we had a really good time with that, bringing in live guests and new music, and basically what we did on Radio 1, we were doing on that show, but... So that all worked well.
So now, Road Song, and I just want to say hello to everybody who may be travelling at the moment, back from a gig, back from a festival.
When Jim Moyer came in, he was very good because he listened. He absolutely listened to what people had to say, what they thought. And he just sat there and listened to the network and thought, that's not right, and made notes and suggestions. And bit by bit, he made the changes. And he was very open to suggestion. One of the conversations I had with him over dinner one night, we went out for dinner, he actually asked me outright, he said, what would you change at Radio 2? And I'm sure I wasn't the first person to suggest it, but I said, you really need a far more rigid playlist. I said, because you're never going to get the cooperation of record companies with artists if you're just playing their records once or twice a week. I said, you need some sort of rotation of some of the bigger records. And that happened quite soon after the conversation. They did have a sort of playlist, but it was ever so loose. And I mean, I think it's great that people have choice and there's a bit of freedom. But I think if it's too, you can never create a sound, and you can never get any support if you're not supporting anything. You'll never get the support back if you're not supporting them.
Sounds of the 60s, Radio 2, Brian Matthews.
Morning, Avids. Right, first up today, Tom Jones.
What's new? What's the Sounds of the 60s. It was always a programme I would enjoy listening to on a Saturday morning. And for years, one day I got a phone call from Radio 2 saying the producer of the programme is leaving. We wondered if you'd be interested in caretaking it for 8 weeks. And I said, well, I'd love to do that. So I met up with Brian, we discussed stuff, I put together the first programme, he seemed really happy. 8 weeks passed, and so did 8 years, and the rest. So I've been doing it ever since. Working with Brian Matthew was, I thought this is a bit of a worry, but then I'd worked with Alan Freeman, I've worked with Roger Scott, I've worked with so many presenters, and I thought, well, I'm sure we'll be fine. And he was good as gold. I presented him with a running order. He played it. I wrote most of the material. He'd rewrite stuff in his own words, but I'd give him all the facts and figures, and he was really pleased because he thought that the programme was getting a little bit tired because they were repeating stuff quite rapidly, whereas I was of the opinion that we could broaden it out a bit with keep the hits going, but also introduce some interesting records.
Mark Winter with a Goffin and King song, bringing us to the end of another edition of Sound of the 60s, compiled and directed by Phil the Collector Swern, as a unique production for Radio 2.
Well, Brian had been off for a long time. He'd been in hospital and been unwell. I could see, I mean, before he went into hospital, for the last year or so, it was getting harder and harder for him to do the programme. And he said that he wanted to come back to it, but it was clear that he couldn't, because he was too unwell to be able to do the programme. So we put together a sort of if I remember rightly, it was a sort of a best of with new links. And he came in, and it was really hard for him. He was really struggling to get through the 2 hours.
That 1962 top five hit by Billy Fury brings me to the end of my reign as presenter of Sounds of the 60s, and I must say I've enjoyed every minute of my 27 years in this chair, and I'm saddened to leave. Sound of the 60s was produced by Tom DeCrow and Phil the Collector Swern as a unique production for Radio 2. And this is your old mate Brian Matthews saying, that's your lot for this week. See you again soon.
He wasn't really enjoying it. You could see he wasn't. He was really struggling. I couldn't give him too much instruction because I didn't want to upset him too much. So we recorded masses more than we ever going to use, and we put a final programme together. The BBC said, look, really, clearly it's going to, you can't do this anymore, but we'd like to offer you some specials every now and again to do whatever you want to do, which he sort of said, yeah, yes, he'd like to do that, but he didn't make it much beyond that. It was the beginning of the end, very, very difficult period of time. But he was still, until about a year before he gave up, he was still right on top of his game, but you could just see the deterioration. So Tim Rice did it for a few months until they settled on Tony Blackburn, who I think is a really good choice, although his outlook to music is very different to Brian's and to mine for that matter. I mean, our music tastes are the same, but I'd like to broaden it a bit. He likes to keep it very mainstream.
Good morning. Welcome to Sounds of the 60s. Tony Blackburn here with you. My first Sound of the 60s. I've been looking forward to this very much.
At Radio 2, I think the change was so gradual that you didn't get a huge amount of fallout. The odd programme might have created a stir. I mean, recently they axed the Organist Entertains, which has been there forever, and I think there's a bit of a hoo-ha over that. But they did it correctly. They did it bit by bit, and so you don't. It wasn't noticeable so much as changing everything in one go. And then, of course, Jim moved on, and Leslie Douglas took over, and she had some very modern ideas and ways of thinking, and it's very good for the network. I mean, she was very keen on younger talent. She was keen that the radio station promoted new artists, and that they brought them into the shows. Yeah, she was a breath of fresh air, to be honest. And unfortunately, there's a difficult situation that created her demise. After Leslie Douglas moved on, Bob Shannon came in to take over as controller, and things didn't change that much with him, but he was very approachable, very nice, and all seemed to work well. Seemed to be quite a happy ship. I mean, Radio 2, I think lots of radio stations now are bringing in personalities to present programs, not necessarily music personalities, but people that are well known to the public. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Personally, I don't think that because you're on television or you're on the stage in theatre, you can present a radio programme and vice versa. And occasionally it works, but I think there's a danger of the art of being a radio presenter could die out, because I don't think there's enough people up and coming now who are keen enough to do it. And I think the more people they bring in from the other side of show business, the less opportunity there's going to be for new talent. Life at Radio 2, working at Radio 2, obviously I don't go there very often, because I go in on a Friday to do, and a Saturday to do my shows. Occasionally I'll go in during the week if I'm called for a meeting, if I need a meeting. Everyone seems to be reasonably happy there, but it is fragmented, because it's a big old place, and you've got press in one end of them and production another, and it's big. That's all I can say. I mean, it works. It works. But lots of the things that BBC have done, especially radio, should not work. They, some of the formats, some of the should never work, and they do. It's the whole picture, the whole programme there. The presenter, the music, the production, just everything makes it work. Lots of stuff there that... And some of the decisions they made, I thought, that's never going to work. Then why are they putting that person in? And it works. And so I'm still now making programmes for Radio 2, doing, obviously, Popmaster, Pick of the Pops with Paul Gambaccini, Sounds of the 60s with Tony Blackburn now, and Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour, which does really well on a Friday night. It's just an hour, but it's a blank sheet of paper, and just anything goes. And I think that's the fascination with that programme, is that you just don't know what's coming next.
Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour.
And thanks very much to Joe and Simon for a great show.
I later became involved in Broadchart, which is now I Like Music. It wasn't my idea at all. No, there was a guy named Andy Hill, who was the CEO, and he had set up a library, a music library supply digital service, but it's all library music, so it's sort of non-copyright, so it's cheaper for the advertising agencies and broadcasters to use. And it worked really well. And he then started getting lots and lots of requests from customers saying, why can't you do it with commercial music? Well, the problem there is all the licenses. So Andy spent years setting this up, and he actually got all the licenses required to set it up. The only thing he didn't have was the material. So a mutual friend suggested we meet up. So I met up with Andy. He came along to my house in Wembley, where I was living at the time, and saw my 250,000 pieces of vinyl. Well, the vinyl was kept in the house in Wembley, and virtually every room was storage, and a loft which went quite high, so there's records everywhere. I mean, I actually made a point of making sure I had every chart record. And if you go back to, it was when I was with Capitol and I was doing that quiz show, You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet, there would be right around questions, and I thought, I can't do that because I haven't got that record. And that's when I thought, I need to get every record in the chart so that I'm never going to be stuck. So I went through the hits book and I marked off the records I didn't have. I ended up with a list of about 500 or 600, and I made it my job to obtain each and every one of those records. So yes, I still do have every chart record ever, every top 40 record, right up to date. Yeah, they I mean, I don't have to worry about it myself now, but they update every single week. They're in a storage place not far from here. So Andy and I, he asked me if I wanted to join forces with him, and we came to an agreement. So he then started digitizing all these, those CDs as well. I mean, there's about 30,000 CDs. So that's where we started. He started digitizing all the CDs, and at that time I was collecting every chart hit ever on CD, which was another mammoth task. I was going here, there, and everywhere, flying to Germany. Picked up lots and lots of stuff in Germany in those days that they put out, they'd release over there. Didn't come out over here on CD. So I eventually collected mostly, nearly all the chart hits on CD. There's still quite a few that have never been released on CD, so we've had to digitise them from the vinyl. And he did a deal with the BBC, because they were looking to have their own digital library, which made sense. And they thought, rather than start from scratch, it'd be better to put it out to tender. And they put this situation out to tender, and I think five companies bid for it, including some of the big players. They sent us a list. They said, here are, I can't remember, 30 or 40 records. Some were well-known songs, some were album tracks, and there was about 8 or 9 really obscure things. I think we came up with everything bar three, and we were miles ahead of any of the competitors. And they obviously liked the system that we developed, so we won the contract. How am I enjoying life now? Well, I've enjoyed my life, well, since I started in the music business. I mean, it's better than working. It beats working every time. It's a joy. I mean, obviously you get the moments when things aren't so great, or you get problems with programs, but they're few and far between, and life's good. Even today, I still go in and talk about new projects and things, and that excites me. I can't sit still. I can't go, oh, well, I've got 3 programmes, that's all I'm going to do, or 4 programmes. I need to find something different, a new twist. How does radio compare to how when I was growing up? But it's, I think it's like all media. Everything is on demand. You can listen to anything, anywhere, anytime, when you want to. So you sort of wonder how much longer there's going to be any necessity for an actual schedule. So from that point of view, it's very different. Immediate involvement with the audience, which is sometimes good, sometimes not so good, because it's ever so easy for them to shout at you. It's different. I suppose that the youngsters who are coming into it now, that's the way that they see it. And probably in 20, 30 years' time, it'll change again. I think radio will survive, but it's changing, it's evolving all the time, as is television, as is media.
Compiled and directed by Phil the Collector Swern.
How I would like to be remembered. Well, not as big an idiot as most people thought I was.